Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
I wouldn't know. That's why I put it up to the billions. I don't claim to know everything. What I do know is that I'm looking at a guy who is in tremendous shape. He looks like he's still playing. My God.
What's up, Kimpo?
Terrell Owens, the Hall of Famer. Joining Joe Lowe and Dibs, 95.7 The Game.
I can't stand him. I can't stand you, T. Boy, look at you. Stay pretty in the
body
face and slim in the waist.
2.7% right now.
What do you weigh right now?
Well,
let's get that mic on.
Wait, come on.
Work the mics.
Mic check.
Look at that.
My goodness.
Look at this. There he is.
You look like a marathoner, Terrell.
Jeez.
Quite frankly, you look like you'd run about a sub 2.5 hour marathon right now. You're so lean.
Well, if it looked like it, that's a good thing.
What do you weigh now compared to what you weighed when you played?
I'm probably like maybe under 210 or right at 210.
What were you when you were playing? Same thing?
222.
Jeez. 222.
It's so crazy. I never weighed over 225.
Right.
And then, you know, obviously they have weight requirements for some guys. Obviously the strength and conditioning coaches, they never really.
Do whatever.
Yeah, they never had any issues with me. But sometimes I just wanted to get on the scale just to see what I would weigh, see if it fluctuated. Yeah. I literally weighed 222 every time I stepped on the thing. It was the weirdest
thing. After eating, no matter what, 220.
It's the weirdest thing. You know, like at the end of the week, you know, they had the weigh-ins.
Right.
It was the weirdest thing. Like, they had weigh-in, and I always went 222.
Did you change much in your diet, what you consumed throughout the week?
I was pretty much fish, chicken, turkey, protein.
So not Ocho going to McDonald's every day.
No, that's why our careers are very different. Very, very different. No, personality is kind of the same.
No.
Nutrition, a little bit different.
I don't know personality. I was with Chad in Cincinnati, and dude, he'd run a 9-round, dude, T.O., and this is rookie year. And then he'd run, he'd do it again, a couple plays, and then he'd fall out like he died, start crying. I'm like, man, what's wrong with this cat?
That's a guy enjoying what he did.
Right. He did it to the fullest, man.
Enjoying what he did.
Hall of Famer Terrell Owens joining Joe Lowe and Dibs on Radio Row here in Miami on 95.7 The Game. You played in a Super Bowl in Florida. You were in Jacksonville. There was a lot of talk about the humidity in that game. Going into this game on Sunday, the weather for people like us looks great. It looks like it's going to be very comfortable, but do you have to prepare differently? Obviously, you were coming back from injury, but those Philadelphia games against Atlanta, against Minnesota, that was in the cold.
Right.
So when you're playing all these late-season games in weather like that, maybe some indoor games, and then you're going to transfer down into the humidity, do you vary up the approach?
Obviously, your conditioning factors in. And like you mentioned, Super Bowl 39, if you remember, that particular year, it was unseasonably cold. I remember my first time practicing, jumping on the field, it was freezing.
Really?
It was raining, cold. Yeah, I mean, you think of Jacksonville, obviously you expected the warmer climate.
Right.
But during the course of that week, it was unseasonably cold. So I think, you know, with these guys, you know, California, think of the San Francisco 49ers, they're used to a little bit of sunshine, not a lot of the humidity.
Right.
So that's something that I think being down here a week early to get their bodies acclimated, you know, would kind of be, you know, kind of to their favor a bit. I think both teams. But again, if you're used to playing in a certain climate throughout the course of the year, you know, playing in some better weather will obviously help you. But those guys, once the whistle's blown, you don't think nothing about the weather.
How was it, T.O.? Did you ever have to – you were an IV guy. You know, a lot of guys before games, sometimes, you know, during the week, they might have got an IV or B12 shot. Did you do any of that stuff?
What was I just tried to, throughout the course of my training and just learning from my trainer about hydration. And then you have the trainers always telling you, hydrate.
Right.
Hydration, man, it saved my career a number of times, because when you think of hydration – bro, it does a lot for the body. it extends your career. It eliminates a lot of pull, strains, injuries, those, you know, tissue injuries that people come up with. And you think about, like, how can these guys, you know, be pulling hamstrings, this and that and the other? That's because they're probably dehydrated. And so I learned, you know, early on to hydrate because it will prevent injuries.
In that your super week, it was more than just hydration and prehydration. You were coming back off a major injury. How frustrating was it, and how tough was it on you, knowing that you had to work every second in the lead up just to be ready enough to be able to go to that game?
Well, that's the thing. I tried to do whatever I could to help with my conditioning and really accelerate the healing process to get back on the field. So if you think about it, I came back within 6.5-7 weeks.
Crazy.
And so I did everything kind of under the sun to get myself, my body ready without the conditioning, because I couldn't do a whole lot of running because the injury that I had sustained, it was a weight-bearing injury. So, you know, once I was able to get on the field and move around a bit and start distributing some weight and see if I was able to play, you know, that helped me mentally, psychologically, you know, okay, I can do this. And I knew that possibly at some point my condition, you know, may come into play. But as I said earlier, once the game started, I didn't really think about, you know, my cardiovascular or anything of that nature. I just was out there just like, okay, I'm here. I've missed, you know, a big the two playoff games, the Super Bowl. It's kind of like win or, you know, do or die. This is championship time. So I, like I said, a lot of these guys, man, they don't know, they take their bodies for granted. And so for me, you think about what I did in that Super Bowl, not being able to really condition my body, you know, for, by the way, honestly, like a month or so, because yeah, I got hurt mid-December of that year. And so I was literally on the couch. I went to surgery the next day and immediately started, you know, rehab. And so I didn't really get a lot of cardiovascular work to probably like 3-4 weeks in.
Wow.
This dude, when this happened, I was in the stands when Roy Williams pulled you down. I was there. I'm from PA. So I'm there with my mom. He goes down. Place goes silent, obviously, because he was the difference. It was three straight years of not getting to the Super Bowl because there were no wide receivers. T.O. comes to town, puts the team over the top. He goes down, place goes silent, he jogs off the field with a broken leg. So everyone's like, all right, if he's jogging off the field, he's fine. Then it comes down that he's out, but he might be able to make it back for the Super Bowl.
Right.
Tracking his every movement with the hyperbaric chamber. The second, it's like, he's got this hyperbaric chamber. That's going to be the difference. Everyone's like, what's that mean? I don't know, but T.O.'s got it. He's sleeping in this thing. He's going to be ready for the Super Bowl.
Yep.
And every single day, that's all you focus on. What was T.O. doing?
Right.
What was he eating? Is he in that hyperbaric chamber? What the hell is the hyperbaric chamber? How's it going to make him healthy? And then played and ball, too. What
balled
double
out.
Digit?
Balled
he
out.
Went over 100 yards. Did you have 10 catches?
Nine for 122.
That's a big game.
You carried a game on one leg. No, it was crazy.
So you and Freddie Mitchell together had 9 receptions, right?
No, I don't do my guy. Don't do my guy.
Come on,
do my guy Fred X like that. That's my guy Freddie.
My guy.
That's my guy Freddie. Don't do him like that.
He's slick. You almost jumped in there. You almost went. Like,
yeah, I was like, nine. But I'm like, what?
I had those 9. Freddie was doing a lot of talking that week. He was getting New England all fired up.
Oh, yeah, Freddie thanked his hands for being so great.
Belichick was like, who is that guy? Belichick was like, he knew you.
And then, you know, I think he went on to say they asked him about the secondary. He was
pretending. Calling out the numbers.
He was like, who? I don't know any names. I just know numbers. So, you know, obviously, you know, Reed didn't take, you know, too kind of that. And he's like, you know, we don't need to be making any headlines, bulletin material, things of that nature. But, you know, you mentioned, you know, when I got hurt, and I remember it vividly. I caught the seam pass, and I was coming back, and I was trying to get outside. And Roy grabbed me from behind. And as I went down, I heard a pop. So because of the angle that I was, you know, torqued pulled down from. And so when I heard the pop,
you know,
I just like, man, in my mind, I was like, oh, shit, I broke my ankle. That's immediately what I said. And so I laid there And I'm like, man, can I get up? And my you just feel the pain.
Oh, I know. I've been there.
And so I'm looking over, and Rick and the training staff, they coming over, and they ask me, they like, T, what's wrong? I said, Rick, I think I broke my ankle. And he's like, what? And then he's like, so I'm looking at him, and they start signaling for the cart. And I'm like, no. I said, Rick, I'm not getting on no cart. Right. And he's like, T, you got to, man. I said, Rick, hold on. Let me see if I can get up. And so I got up. And so everybody tried to, you know, use them as some leverage, a crutch. And then I just like, man, I just limped off. You know, I just all the way to the sideline. And then when I got to the sideline, I really kind of, you kind of just felt that pain. Because I tried to
the adrenaline kind of goes out.
But yeah, I wanted those fans to know, like, okay, even when I didn't know the results, I didn't know exactly what was going on. I wanted those fans to know, okay, you got T.O. This is what I came here for. If there's anything in my power to get up off this field for whatever reason, I'm going to show them that's what they were made of.
Right.
You know, that's that type
tough,
of town.
Tough town,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, it's a gritty town. And you know,
and then, of course, being Philly, he runs off. So everyone's like, what's he doing? He ran off. Get your ass back out of here. Get it.
Right,
Cowboys.
Exactly. So, but me, like, yeah.
Philly.
My thing is, you know, I know as a fan, you're looking at like, okay, he's walking. Okay, he may have an opportunity to come back. But I knew I wasn't coming back in that game. And so I just wanted to get back to the locker room and really understand the extent of the injury. And so once we did all of that, you know, they x-rayed it. And they didn't, you know, they x-rayed my ankle. And there wasn't a break. You know, it was just, you know, at that time, it was just tissue stuff. And so fast forward, go home. I ice it. They tell me to go home, keep it elevated. And throughout the night,
throbbing.
I did it. Oh, my gosh. It was the most excruciating. I couldn't sleep. And so I kept reaching for my up by my knee. And I'm like, man. So I told Rick, and he's like, you know, how'd you do through the night? And Rick Burkhold is the trainer he's the trainer for the Kansas City Chiefs. Andy Reid took him with the Chiefs.
Right.
And so he's still there. And so he asked me, you know, how did I do throughout the night? And I said, I iced it. I elevated it. And I said, Rick, my up by my knee area, I said, it was throbbing all night. So he was like, all right, cool. They took me down. I got to the radiologist. And so I explained to him. I was like, yo, I said, up by my knee area, I said, it was aching all night long. And he said, all right, cool. We'll just x-ray the whole area, whole leg or what have you. And then that's when it was revealed that I had a small fracture in my tip, my fibula.
So the weight-bearing bone or the non-weight-bearing?
Yep.
It was the weight-bearing
bone? It was the weight-bearing,
okay, yeah. So that's what I was playing the Titans. And 44, one who ended up going to Denver, not Denver, but ended up playing for Detroit Lions that Swartz went and got away.
Oh, Vandenbosch.
Vandenbosch.
Yeah.
Rolled up on my ankle, broke the non-weight bearing, hopped off the field. But you know right away, when those things are broken, it's like, man, you just feel that throb, feel it just aching. Mm-hmm. And when we watched UT, even though we were playing at the same sense, everybody was, no, that's T.O. Even guys in the league, it doesn't matter. We were watching the update. Is he going to play for Philly? What is he going to do? So you had such a huge sphere of influence in the National Football League. Any media, the helicopters, people circling around you because not because just the person you are, but because the player that you are. When you're like that, like a superstar, that, you know, you can stop the media because you could demand that much attention because you're that type of player. What does it do to you when you see a guy like Kobe, a guy, you know, that in arguably in a sport that Kobe knows you, everyone in, doesn't matter if it's hockey, baseball, they know who T.O. was. And of course, Kobe on a larger level, when you see this tragedy thing, what does it make you just think about just being a human, but yet still people look at, you know, as superstars?
I think with Kobe, I mean, he had such an amazing upbringing. When you think about him growing up internationally, his dad playing overseas, and you think about how he grew up in the different cultures, I think it was so fascinating that, you know, he was able to go in a press conference and speak different languages because of that experience. And so when you have a mom and a dad and you have that upbringing and they kind of groom you to be who you are or who they think you're going to be, it's a special thing to see. And so you saw the transformation, the transition with Kobe, even as a teenager. You know, as a teenager, he already kind of knew, he had the mindset, the wherewithal, more than any average, you know, teenagers to know this is what I want to be. This is who I want to be. And he had that in Michael Jordan. He patterned himself. You don't really have a lot of kids these days that have the thought process to kind of already map kind of their careers out. And that's what Kobe kind of did, in a sense. And so he was able to kind of embrace it. And as you saw, even though he matured along the way, but he was still that teenager. He was still that kid that was right. That little kid, that vibrant kid about him. But it was just so great to see what he was able to do and just transition and just even listen and watch highlights and hear stories about how he became, you know, the Black Mamba, right. And how he used Michael Jordan as his barometer for success. And I spoke on Undisputed yesterday, and it was just like, you know, he's probably the best person ever living, almost the closest clone to Michael Jordan we will ever see. And I think he did that to a T. It was like this guy was maniacal in his approach to success, his drive, his passion. It was a relentless pursuit to be the best that he could be. If he could pass Michael Jordan, he would have. That's why I think he played 20 years and he pushed him to the nth degree, his body to the nth degree, because he wanted that sixth championship. He wanted to mimic Michael Jordan, what he did and what he personified. As you saw, I mean, he had Michael Jordan down almost to the walk,
right.
You know, early on.
Right.
And then
right.
It became like, okay, he saw like, I can't be Mike. Let me be Kobe. You know, then he became the Black Mamba, you know, they call Michael Jordan. Through friends, and I've heard Black Cat. You know, so there's a lot of similarities to how he wanted to mirror image, you know, Michael Jordan. But when you talk about him coming into stardom, and for him to know that, have that ability and skill set as a high schooler to go jump from high school to the pros. Bro, that's a special gift. That's a special talent. And so when you think about it and you talk about, like, I never experienced that at that level, especially as a teenager, to understand the skill set and to think that you can go play with pros and actually beat some professional guys.
Right.
I never had that ability. But as I transitioned and as my career started to ascend, I had to learn to embrace the popularity that I was beginning to gain year in and year out. And so it started with San Francisco playing 8 years in an already star-studded environment. You think about the guys that had played
right.
with the Niners before
right.
I got there. I knew nothing really about the 49ers until I got drafted. I knew of Jerry Rice, Steve Young, and that's pretty much about it. I never really watched football as a teenager, as an adolescent, because my grandmother, you know, I was sheltered. She didn't allow me to watch a lot of TV. And when I did watch TV, I went across the street and watched basketball at my dad's house. And that was literally before I knew who he was. And so I was just going across the street as a neighbor,
wow.
You know, watching basketball. And, you know, he knew that I loved basketball. I remember watching, you know, those matchups,
yeah.
The Bulls and the Lakers.
Right.
Watching,
right.
You know, the play where Michael Jordan went up and he thought he was going to dunk it. And then
iconic.
I remember that sitting, you know, at my dad's house on the floor model TV. Like, those are some of the things that I remember. I never thought I would play football, or football wasn't even on my radar.
Wow.
Wasn't even on my radar. So when I started to follow the game of basketball, obviously, like you said, there's no really heated rivalries like the Detroit Pistons, the Bad Boys.
Right,
there's none of those teams, the Utah Jazz is with Karl Malone and Stockton. Those teams aren't like that anymore. And so that was my passion, was to play basketball. And even when I got right. recruited to play at UT Chattanooga from Benjamin Russell, I still didn't think right. I would play beyond the collegiate level. I only got to Chattanooga on the heels of them recruiting someone else.
They just happened to notice you while they were looking at someone else?
Yeah, so the linebackers coach, well, you know.
Nice find.
So that's the thing about high school, you learn now, which is why I don't really want to do coaching is like these high school, you know, they go on the road and they start scouting once the season ends, and they send different position coaches in certain regions. And so Bobby Johns, he was the linebacker coach. Right. And so they sent him down in our area. And so Derek Hall was our starting receiver. So that's who they came down to see and recruit. And so he was watching. They said, you know, they was watching film on Derek. And during that course of the game, I made a few plays here and there. And so obviously I had the size, you know, and so that's how I got to UT Chattanooga.
Wow. With your talent, T, these are just questions, man. I always just thought, sorry, I'm just off key. I know we got to get in the Niners, but
no, take your time. We pushed the break. Good. Terrell Owens is joining.
Yeah,
Terrell Owens.
We're good. We're good.
So when you know, with your talent and who
that doesn't
you
mean
are,
you ask all the questions, but you know,
it,
a little bit.
You're saying that you didn't have necessarily the guidance and the push and those different things. Knowing who you are now as a man, but knowing your skill sets then, if you knew that the pushing, what is the sky? What is the limits you think that you could reach? If you're thinking about it, you would have had the same type of.
I thought about this yesterday because, you know, I was on the set of Fox and Shannon and them. They started asking me about Kobe and I recanted some of the things that I had seen and heard about, you know, him getting up at like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning to go work out. And then, you know, I got back in the car and I'm driving, you know, back and I'm like, man, just think, like, if I had his approach as a kid, as a young kid,
right.
as he did with basketball, or Michael Jordan did as you know, as he did with basketball, or even Jerry as he did with football, what kind of player I would have been. I honestly do. I feel like I was a basketball player in a football uniform. And I started to realize the skill set that I had once I got drafted and the opportunity that was presented to me being drafted with the Niners. So I wanted to take full advantage of the opportunity because, you know, like I said, my mom couldn't afford a lot of things, you know, coming out of high school, going into college. And so being drafted with the 49ers afforded me a lot of opportunities to better my life. And so as an adolescent,
right.
I just never really thought I would have, you know, been or be where I am now. I never had the vision or anything to motivate me until I got to the league and I saw how these guys were living. I saw what being in the National Football League afforded guys to do, and it changed their lifestyle. You know, some of the things that motivated me may not have motivated a lot of other people. It takes me back to my high school when I'm running track or baseball or I'm playing basketball and my mom can't come pick me up because we don't have a car.
Wow.
And I got to hitch a ride with one of my teammates, or my coach has to take me home. Those are the things that motivated me to become who I became. And it's so sad that over the course of my career, there are people in position to understand who I was as a player, and as a not just a player but as a person,
didn't
take upon the responsibility, not only just as a coach but know me as a person, that spread rumors about me of who they thought I was. And so for so many years,
misperception,
I've been misperceived to be this arrogant, selfish, cocky guy, a guy that ruined a lot of locker rooms. And you know, it's unfair, you know, that people have been gone to school for journalism, and I feel like they violated those code of ethics when you have to really know what you're doing. And just because one person says something about an individual, you're trying to do your job and you're trying to make headlines and you're trying to, you know, create a story to push yourself and put yourself in a light with your job description or occupation. One person or player or coach doesn't speak for the majority of the locker room. And that's why I've adamantly tried to defend my character. You know, you know, people can say this, that, and the other about me, but I've always defended my character from the standpoint of, we're talking about fathers. I didn't have a father growing up. So I relied on what my mom and my grandmother taught me. They taught me to be a good person. And so that's what I've always tried to present, is to be a good person.
Wow.
If I was a bad person or this, like I said, did I make some mistakes? Of course. That's because of the maturation process that we all go through when we're teenagers, and then we're 21, 22, 23 year old. We're different than when we are 30, 40. And so those are some of the things that I had to go through. And I understand that, you know, people have this perception on me based on media portrayal, which is grossly inaccurate. Because, like I said, I know who I was in that locker room. Over the years, like I said, I walk places, I've gone places, and I see people, and I know people think certain things about me because of how polarizing the media is and what people have said about me. And so for me, I've always tried to defend my character in that regard, because I know who I was in that locker room. Because as Marcus Spears said last year, and he looked in the camera, you know, at ESPN, and he said, I played with this guy for 3 years. He was nothing but a great teammate. And for Skip Bayless to continue to say, call me team obliterator, this, that, and the other, based on one or two people that are coaches or whatever that he may have spoken to, and that be my character, you know, going out all these years, is very unfortunate.
T.O. is joining us here on 95.7 The Game. I want to follow up on that point, too, because defenders of yours have always made a great point that you hear about the issues in the locker room, but there was never anything off the field. Never once. Like, exactly. If you're such a bad guy, the point was always, if you're such a bad guy, how come you never hear about anything
anywhere else? Absolutely. And it's disheartening. It's frustrating, Lo.
Sure. No question, bro.
You know, and it's the thing. It's like, you know, for me to be who I am and to have accomplished the things that I've done on the football field, you would think that, yeah, I would have been more marketable in a lot of situations.
No question.
But because of how the media portrayed me, I've had marketing guys with one of the top agents. And when I transitioned, I tried to do things different because I knew how the world saw me because of how the media portrayed me. So I wanted to try to do certain things different, you know, try to carry myself almost in a different way. But I wasn't. It wasn't like I was doing anything. I wasn't doing anything different. But I knew how the world perceived me based on how the media covered me. So it was some of those things. Like, yeah, I've done business things or what have you, and I didn't get certain things, or I felt like I deserved certain things, and I would ask them, like, dude, why am I not this? And I would go, I've gone to a number of meetings, and people have met me. They're like, oh my God, like,
blown away.
You're so marketable. You're handsome. You're this, you're that.
I don't
know
that part.
I mean, you know.
Oh, this dude wanted to take off your shirt.
You see, now when you talk about people in the media misrepresenting things, yeah. Here's Exhibit A.
Right.
By the way, speaking of that, though, you still got those abs?
Yeah, I got a couple, one or two.
I was curious because our board op, nice guy Steven, he's back in the studio. His big thing was, right. He kept telling me, I remember back in the day when you were doing the sit-ups, the abs, man, they were like on the slant. They were something I'd never seen before. He was saying, you got to ask T.O., can you see the abs? I'm doing it for nice guy Steven. Not a personal question. Lorenzo. Yeah. Right. If you are so inclined on the way out, just give us a pop, flash an ab. You know, that's right. Gonna say, because I mean, the man's looking good.
I don't want to do that. I don't want Lo to hyperventilate or anything.
Fair.
We got to make sure some EMT medics are nearby. You know
fair.
What I mean?
Hey,
T.O., just being able to talk to you, man, on a personal level, man. I tell you, right now, just. A lot of people don't even know that. I mean, for you sharing and opening up to us, man, to the billions, I mean, I'm telling you, the text line's probably blown up. Just people don't know these stories, and they don't know the individual, and you're right, the perception. Man, do you go on a speaking tour and have the opportunity,
yeah,
man, to tell your
honestly,
story, man? It was moving.
I mean, I've done that. I do speaking engagements, and people are blown away by my story. And that's the thing. Early on, you know, we didn't have the social media platform to dispute or dispel some of these things. And it's so, for me, I think it's so unfair because all, you know, some of these encounters that I had in San Francisco, like the arguments and stuff, you know, people said stuff that happened in the locker room in San Francisco, or especially in Philadelphia and even in Dallas. You know, and the thing is I never did anything wrong. People just expected it because the media pushed it as if I was always the problem, but I really wasn't. And then there were guys that were in that locker room, they wanted to speak on my behalf. But okay, they're not going to jeopardize their job speaking out on my behalf because they're going to mess around and get cut because it's something, you know, going against the grain a bit. And so, but again, I've had those teammates that talk to me personally, call me, and they're like, dude, you're in the right. Like, dude, you didn't do anything wrong. I've even talked to coaches, my individual coaches. They even saw the disservice of what was going on.
Right.
Even with some of the coaches and people within the organization. I had Ray Sherman, I had Larry Kirksey, I had George Stewart, David Culley.
Oh,
those guys were like mentors, like father
right.
figures to me.
Right.
And if I was doing anything so grossly wrong, they would have told me. They would have pulled me to the side, like, T, don't do this. And I would have listened to him.
Do you think it's a way, because I don't know, but it's a way in which you probably at that time communicated. You said, hey, look, I didn't have, you know, necessarily the father or the people to tell me how I should handle things because maybe, oh, hey, this is who I am. Would you confront it right away?
But
did people think that was, would they take that as you being disrespectful?
No, but that's what I was mentioning about. There are certain coaches that are in positions. Again, being a head coach. Yeah, you're not supposed to babysit anybody, but there's some responsibilities that come with being a coach. You have to know the people that you're, the players in your locker room, not just on a performance level. And so even in San Francisco, you know, I mean, I've spoken openly about it. I don't like Coach Mariucci. There were some double standards that were given in that locker room. And so for me, I witnessed a lot of things that, you know, he gave guys preferential treatment. And it wasn't because I was jealous of those guys. I was either equally or better, but he gave those guys different preferential treatment, you know, and just treated them a bit different. It was a double standard. And so those are things that I'll never forget. And I could have said something then, but again, I listened to those coaches, my position coaches in that locker room. They were like, we had a bond, and I knew that with them, I was safe. I wouldn't be comfortable going into the coach's office and talking to Mariucci. I just didn't, because I just knew that he didn't relate to me. Based on how I was raised, based on how my grandmother, I watched my grandmother, raise us. I listened to conversations that she had with her friends about how she grew up in the South, you know, picking cotton, you know, being a black American, black person. Those are things that I recount and I recall growing up. And we didn't have discussions. I wasn't educated enough to ask her about certain things, but I do recall the conversations that she was having with her friends at those early ages. And it showed itself when I played, when I was older and I was in certain situations and I saw how I was being treated.
I appreciate you sharing so much about these stories, because these are things that, you know, the perception. I've followed your career ever since you were with the Niners all the way through, and the perception has been exactly
what you're
talking about. So along with changing the perception of how you were looked at, what else are you looking forward to for your post-football career? What are the things that you're passionate about?
Honestly, just making a difference in kids' lives. I don't think I'll be a coach. Per se, but I have done speaking engagements and I've shared a little bit of my story, some of what you guys have heard and the listeners have heard today, and people are blown away. And so I know that I'm a good person, you know, despite, like I said, over the years, I've taken so much criticism and just the strength of my grandmother. And I know how she raised me. That's what enabled me to still go out on that field, knowing that people were saying inaccurate things about me, and there were coaches and there were players that may have disliked me for whatever reason. That's what enabled me to still go out on that field and play to the highest level, because I think I was smart enough to know, okay, if I go out here and play bad, understanding everything that had swirled around that particular incident or circumstance, it was only if I played poorly, it was going to validate what they were saying. And I tried my damnedest not to do that, and I did it. And I just blocked it out, and I really just stayed close. I called my mom like every on the ride to the stadium every game. That's what gave me my energy, my spirit, my everything. And when I lost my grandmother in 2012, but I had lost her early on because she was diagnosed with dementia, and it obviously progressed to Alzheimer's. And so I do a lot of stuff with Alzheimer's as well. Spoke before Congress in 2000 with Mike Martz to increase the awareness increase the funding for Alzheimer's. But my grandmother and how she raised me, it allowed me to block out the Skip Baylesses of the world, the Sean Salisbury, the Mark Scratch, people that piggybacked on the negative stories. And like I said, if I had the platforms that we have, these social media platforms that we have today, and it was almost like the media, it almost prevented guys from having voices. And now guys, you know, you think about the NBA and what they're doing, and guys are standing up, being a voice. You know, it's almost like these platforms have given the voiceless a voice. And so I wish I could have done that. And I tried to do that with certain interviews. And then I realized, okay, it's a production. These guys are taking snippets from an hour and a half interview, and the public doesn't see the whole entire interview. There are things that I said or shared, but they never knew about all the incidents that were, you know, that were swirling or surrounding me.
No easy way to pivot, but we're up against it. And I got to ask you, who do you like in the game? Believe it or not, we're in Miami for the Super Bowl.
Yeah, exactly.
We got so deep. It was such a great conversation.
I know. I thought it was
so deep.
Tony Robbins, Ed Milet.
I mean, you got me all motivated. Man. I'm like, man, I'm going to go work out, man.
Yeah. Man, and that's what motivated me to do. Once I saw, you know, and drafted, you know, to the Niners, and I saw, you know, Jerry Rice, you know, I think, you know, I was fortunate to play with Jerry Rice. It would be equivalent to like Kobe playing with the Bulls, you know what I mean? Being drafted to the Chicago Bulls.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And playing under, you know, and seeing Michael Jordan. And that's kind of how it was. I didn't really know who Jerry Rice was. I told you, I was clueless to really, or didn't have any aspirations beyond the collegiate level. And so the Niners, like I said, they're known for championships. They have five. The last was in 94. They went to the last Super Bowl they went to was 2012 with Colin Kaepernick. Yep. and that group against the Ravens. They ended up coming up short. And now here they are, you know.
Can they stop Mahomes? How do you?
Eight
how
years
do you see
later. It? Oh, absolutely. I think they. I'm for sure they can stop Mahomes. They've been battle tested throughout the course of the year. When you think about the guys that they played with late in the season, your Aaron Rodgers. You know, they got a good test with. You know, when we talk about athletic ability wise with Lamar Jackson. So you think about Mahomes. He possessed
Russell
a little
Wilson.
Bit. He Russell Wilson. He possessed a little Russell.
Kyler Murray.
Patrick Mahomes possessed a little Aaron. He possessed a little Lamar Jackson, a little Russell. He has all of those intangibles. And I'm sure Robert Saleh, the defensive coordinator, he knows what he's up against. Not only that, he's going to have those guys prepared for what they're about to be up against. This is what they've prepared for all year. And I think they'll be ready. When you think about that front seven, that defensive front, and especially those guys, when you talk about Armstead, Buckner, Bosa, these guys, yeah, Greenlaw, these guys will be ready. And like I said, I told Richard Sherman, I texted Richard Sherman, I was like, yo, y'all better be ready because Andy Reid is going to be ready. He's going to game plan because he knows what he's up against as well with that defensive front. And so just as well as the defensive front, they know what they got. They got a big task with Patrick Mahomes. And what's going to be key is, you know, they got Tyreek Hill. Andy Reid is going to utilize this guy to the best of his ability. Tyreek has been kind of quiet. He has injuries early on in the year, but you see, he's going to utilize that special weapon in Tyreek Hill the best way they possibly can. And when you think about the weapons that they have on offense, you're Travis Kelce. He's equivalent to that. He's equivalent to George Kittle. You know what I mean? And you think about Sammy Watkins.
Right.
You know, it's going to be a tough game. It's going to be a toss-up. It's going to boil down, as you know, it's not just cliche, who makes the least amount of mistakes and the
turnovers.
Least amount of turnovers. Because
yeah.
If you think, just think about this. D. Ford, who's now with the San Francisco 49ers,
yep.
He was the one that jumped offside last year. He could have they would have had a Super Bowl had it not been for that, because it negated
the interception. Sure.
It negated the interception, and honestly, they would have won that game. And D. Ford probably wouldn't be in San Francisco.
Wow. The butterfly play.
One way to look at it.
I'm telling you, I don't think
there's so many ways to peel that back. That's why I like him to have a big game. Everyone's
right.
Sleeping on him. Everyone, every time you hear his name, you just hear about that mistake.
Right.
And I think he's just sitting there thinking, I'm gonna show
right.
you all.
Exactly. You got to think that leading up to this, how motivated he is. Dude, that was a costly mistake. Very costly. And that's why you have to be on your P's and Q's. And it, the error of the margin of error is slim, and you have to be on your best game when you're playing in the Super Bowl, because there is no tomorrow.
Right.
I remember, you know, playing in the Super Bowl, and then we end up losing, and you know that the commercial tomorrow, tomorrow. I remember that because there is no tomorrow. It's you get that one game, that one time. And for me, fortunately, I was able to play in one Super Bowl. That was going, you know, my ninth year. And, you know, I know we spoke about, you know, the conditioning and, you know, everybody's brought up, you know, the thing with Donovan McNabb. And, you know, and for me, I tried to do whatever I could do to prepare myself, you know, for the biggest game in my career. And I've read, you know, Donovan and I, the whole untold stories and him saying certain things about me. I'm going back and forth on Twitter, and I had a lot of my fans, you know, to my defense. And so even with that, man, it's like it's unfortunate, you know, to try to, you know, bring up or dig up or relive some stuff that happened years ago and try to blame me, you know, for the shortcomings. Especially of the Super Bowl. And so for me, I read one of the, this is not me, I didn't say this, so people listening, I read one of the comments, it's like, man, T.O. was, you know, in his hyperbaric chamber preparing, you know, for the biggest game, you know, of his career, and Donovan's down the hall the night before getting, you know, boozed up, this and that and the other, and I think
before the game,
that's what people were saying, that's why he threw up. And so that's not me throwing shade, these are things that I'm reading on the comments. I'm reading the comments, and these are things that, like I said, there are some things that I found out, you know, since then or what have you. But my focus, you know, going into that Super Bowl game, honestly, like I said, it really took, because I was injured, I think my focus shifted, you know, more so about me going out there and performing to the best of my ability.
Not winning, performing. I got it. Because your mind said.
No, because I was limited. No. I was limited. Knowing that I was hurt, I wasn't 100%. I tried to do whatever I could, man. That's why I felt like, you know, it was so amazing. I remember a square out that I ran, and I know it wasn't but the grace of God, dude. Because, you know, with the injury that I had,
you got to plant hard on that foot
and get out
there.
I planted, yes. And then I came out of my route. And I caught the ball. Like, I literally just, it was just repetition. And I caught the ball.
All right. Last thing we got to ask you is we got to wrap here. Okay. Just prediction for the game. We're asking all the guests that come by. You don't have to put a score on it or anything if you don't want to, but do you have a lean as to how you see this ending on Sunday?
You know, they say defense wins championships. And so you think about the better of the two defenses, I think that the scale kind of tips toward the San Francisco 49ers.
Beautiful. It's brought to you by FitAid, the number one post-workout recovery drink in America. Terrell Owens, the Hall of Famer, kind enough to join us here on 95.7 The Game. That was awesome. Thank you for sharing, man. That was really enlightening.
Kobe has been an inspiration to me, man, and I'm deeply saddened. My prayers go out to he and his family, you know, especially his wife. I got a chance to, you know, my last time seeing his daughter played, my daughter at a volleyball game. Again, you know, his older daughter Natalia played at Sage Hill, and so that was my last time, you know, speaking and talking to him in person. So, you know, like I said, man, I think he's motivated, inspired a number of people for a number of reasons. And so for me sharing my story, man, like I said, you know, life is short. There's, you know, we don't know where we may be tomorrow. And so especially so evident of his sudden passing, and it's just unexpected. So, you know, that's where I'm coming from. You're just sharing my story, man.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly.